Tarek Mitri, who is director of the Issam Fares Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs at the American University of Beirut. He has a distinguished record of public service, having served successive governments in Lebanon and in different portfolios. Between 2005 and 2011, he served as Minister of Environment, Minister of Administrative Reform, Minister of Culture, Minister of Information, and Acting Minister of Foreign Affairs. I assume you are quite happy to go to an academic environment after this. Professor Mitri has also served as Special Representative of the UN Secretary General and has been head of the UN Support Mission in Libya from 2012 to 2014. Among the many things that he does, he is chair of the Board of Trustees of the Institute of Palestine Studies and a member of the Executive Board of the Arab Center for Research and Public and Policy Studies in Doha in Qatar. He has taught at universities all around the world and authored a number of books and articles on religion and politics and interreligious and intercultural dialogue, and he has published in Arabic, English and French, reminding me, of course, of the limitations of my own monolingualism. Professor Mitri.
Thank you so much, moderator. J'interviens en anglais. Unsurprisingly, issues of radicalization and the so-called de-radicalization, as well as those concerning the genesis of violence and exit from it, are widely and rather confusedly debated in recent literature. Taking note of its wealth and diversity evokes, in my view, a paradox of the plenty. The more there is, and there is a lot, the less people understand. Therefore, more is needed to learn the lessons and produce a comprehensive and better articulated knowledge. It's my hope that your international panel, with the tools it possesses and the people it purports to energize, will contribute to a wide embracing and not always conventional knowledge, produces a knowledge that proves to be more relevant to those who are in the policy world and to those who are in public action as well. To be sure, we miss among many of those who focus on Islamic jihadism or Islamic terrorism a sustained interest in other violent movements. We miss equally the intellectual curiosity to examine the links between political violence and criminal violence. In addition, there does not seem to be enough efforts to make the necessary distinctions between religious motivation and religious legitimation, between the end of massive cruelty and the exit from violence. Exit from violence may lead to another form of violence, and between modes of individual persuasion, manipulation, and recruitment of fighters on the one hand, and the communal appeal of such movements on the other. In addition, some of the discussions around de-radicalization tend to tap into psychological research, with the risk of underestimating the use of sociological investigation. Similarly, the inquiry into radicalization processes could not be exclusively informed by trendy political studies that are inclined to overstate perceptions, attitudes, and opinions. The modern and more specifically recent history of Islamic and Muslim majority countries, to be sure, deserves greater attention than recent opinion polls. A careful scrutiny of continuity and discontinuity between the evolution of movements that are lumped into political Islam and the more recent emergence of violent radical groups, especially Daesh, is crucial. For this organization, Daesh, could not be singled out only for its brutality as a policy, but also for its ability to reinvent apocalyptic dreams, control swathes of territories, and rule over its inhabitants. We are a policy institute, we're not a think tank, and therefore our association with your panel would hopefully enlighten us to deal less reluctantly, so far I've been dealing reluctantly, with requests from governments and organizations to convene, join, contribute towards initiatives of violent prevention and exit from radical extremism. More often than not, there is not enough patience among politicians and in the media for making distinctions between various actors and even less between concepts or quasi-concepts. Terms like Islamic, Islamists, radical, Muslim, Salafists, jihadist, and terrorist are used indiscriminately. There is little taste for conceptual precision and contextual differentiation. In all likelihood, the international panel would be capable of addressing, hopefully, this deficit in knowledge, and I dare say intellectual honesty, and contributing, therefore, to a new policy conversation. Such a conversation will lead inevitably to a critical assessment of present policies of prevention and leads to a revision of previously templated recommendations. For us, policy conversations are extremely valuable, provided we are aware of two pitfalls. The first is to assume that the concerns of researchers and policymakers are identical. The second pitfall is to lay emphasis on separation between the worlds of serious academics and that of experienced practitioners. In the first case, researchers risk turning into experts, responding to specific needs and requests. They are rewarded by bridging the gap between reflection and action, but they lose part of their independence, which is their force. But in the second case, which is even more dangerous, they isolate themselves and may fall into irrelevance, and develop an illusory self-sufficiency of only interaction with their peers. It is therefore essential to tread a narrow path between these two pitfalls. I think the minister said it in so many words. Engaging in a relationship between producers of scientific knowledge and decision makers and opinion makers, without confusing roles, while trying to ensure a benefit for both actors through bringing closer evidence-based knowledge and policy thinking. Today, much of the government-driven policy recommendations, as well as those proposed to government, pivot around debilitating, short of completely defeating ISIS. While recognizing that only one part of the solution must be military, the clarity of recommendations about denying territorial gains, continuing to focus on high-value targets, shutting down foreign fighters' pipelines, all of this contrasts with a vague reference to countering Islamist ideology. The task is often outsourced to specialized institutions and NGOs. The ideological battle revolves around convincing Muslims of a putative, moderate interpretation of Islam. The centerpiece of prevention and de-radicalization is ideological / theological re-education. An inculcation of an understanding of Islam as a religion that rejects blind violence is regarded by those NGOs as the most effective and durable reform. by means of dialogue with scholars, clerics, and other authority figures, as well as highlighting testimonies and stories of former militants, many programs aim at the general Muslim public. And some of other programs place less emphasis on ideology and insist on what they call behavioral disengagement. Behavioral disengagement. Last year, I got to know a number of NGOs in my country, Lebanon, with unconventional designations, starting with a designation, Seeming, Haven Square. And they told me, we are part of a peer-to-peer organization that challenges extremism. And of course, we are funded by USAID and the European Union. Bravo. They are part of a broader competitive initiative. Some of them target the general public. Others are preoccupied with committed Muslims, those who go to mosque, pay zakat, and fast. And a few are obsessed with Salafists. In my discussions with them, I was surprised by their insistence of being non-political. Not only in the sense of not positioning themselves politically, but also in avoiding to look into the politics of savagery and the role of foreign occupation, such as in Iraq, dictators' tyranny, such as in Iraq and Syria, and social marginalization as breeding violence. They don't want to look into this. Equally surprising were their reductionist understanding of the role of religion, and their even more reductionist understanding of the Sunni-Shiite divide, which we all know is first and foremost political, and only in a subsidiary manner had become religious. Lastly, their perceptions of potential recruits of radical movements were significantly blurred. Their conversations invite four comments that I will make, and that will be the end of mine. The first is about the weakness of state institutions and the fragility of national cohesion that is exacerbated further by the rapid and unanticipated collapse of the old order have favored the tendency to overemphasize the strength of communal ties. One could not ignore the resurgence and the reinvention of subnational identities and centrifugal forces at work in many Arab countries. Many members of communities, not only minorities, seem to have lost their aspirations to a state for all. They beg for a power structure that can protect them from another community. Weakened states and strategies of mobilization accentuate communalism, and encourage the surfacing of narratives of victimhood, often emotional and aggressive. Throughout the 20th century, members of ethnic groups and ethnicized religious groups struggled to assert themselves as citizens. Many of them retreated into community-centered organizing principles. Some opt for autonomy and advocate separatist solutions to the weakened states and fragmented societies. The very conflicts that undermine what is left of the state became, for many rulers of the region, a source of legitimacy, a cause for further entrenching a distraction from addressing problems they are not capable or willing to solve, such as in Syria, Iraq, Libya, and Yemen. It's not therefore to see violence becoming a policy by default. Two, the debate regarding the relationship of jihadi violence to Islam is often caught between the argument that the former is driven by the latter, at the insistence that Islam has little to do, on the one hand, if any, with violence. It is contaminated by the expediency among politicians and polemicists. Some speak of Islam's essence as pacific, others speak of Islamic essence as violent. Religions, and not only Islam, are a spiritual world, an intellectual resource on which people draw and use for a variety of private and public purposes. Recognizing that religions respond to such needs could not obscure the fact that religions limit what is acceptable and what is recommendable. Some argue that Quranic interpretations lead to political violence and even suggest causal relationship. In fact, it's more often the case than political violence. Political violence creates the conditions for an interpretation, for a violent interpretation of Quranic verses. I mean, those verses have been interpreted throughout century and had not necessarily led to political violence. It's the political violence that led to this kind of interpretation. The instigation, moving to my second point, the instigation of an all-out war against Shia Muslims by ISIS is deemed sensitive, to be underlined, as a determining factor in the strategy by some of those who counter radical Islamists. Needless to say that this strategy takes advantage of an existing and severe polarization that manifests itself as a defining principle in regional and national politics, especially in Iraq. The greatest threat perceived by the Iraqi Shiite government leaders is less jihadism, don't be shocked, than Sunni revanchism. For many of those who recognize the force of communalist and sectarian enmities, they tend to depict them as modern manifestation of ancestral hatred. But the story of Shiites and Sunnis is not a story of ancestral hatred. Wars and conflicts and power struggle invent ancestral hatred. A number of studies, my last point, in the Arab world and in Europe conclude that a large number of people involved in terrorism are far from being pious. They're not pious Muslims, at least most of them are not. In fact, many, many are not literate in things Islamic. They're illiterate. They could be petty criminals who have turned to superficial religiosity, and they do not kill or die for religion, but for themselves, if one can say so. The Westerners who traveled to Syria and Iraq to join ISIS are not, most of them, I claim, are not acting out of a commitment to the community of historical Islam. Rather, they are acting as isolated individuals, and the Islam they embrace is fragmented and patched together out of a remnant of a large historical narrative. There is limited violence in Upper Egypt, which was a hotbed of radical Islam 30 years ago. Pourquoi? Why is it so? It seems that the long tradition of radical Islam have inoculated many against new waves of radicalism. So in Egypt, but elsewhere in Lebanon, those who joined Daesh do not come from the Salafi movement, as many people in the radicalization, de-radicalization industry presuppose. A number of studies in Lebanon, such as the book on Salafism authored by Saud al-Mawla, and a study at our university that we are about to conclude, show that Salafists are hardly tempted to join the ranks of violent jihadists. They're not. So there is no single explanation that for what drives a person to embrace violent extremism. Daesh is far from being homogeneous. It actually includes people of different backgrounds. Religious zealots, there are religious zealots among them, but they are joined by former Ba'athists of Iraq, former Qaddafists of Libya, former tortured prisoners in Iraqi and Syrian prisons, pragmatic tribal Yemenis or Syrians, psychopaths, opportunists, and war profiteers. All of this makes Daesh. It's not a bunch of pious Muslims that make Daesh. And therefore, policies countering extremism and promoting de-radicalization without recognizing this is bound to remain deficient. Merci, madame.